proton radius puzzle and some very elementary slides on how we measure it, along with very basic theory. And then I'll talk about some theoretical issues that we've addressed in this paper as to try to resolve this puzzle. And I'll talk about three further aspects to the analyses, the previous analyses that we've taken a closer look at in this paper. One is the radiative corrections, and two are the systematics that are looked at in these experiments. And then I'll close with our results. So this is the PDG, a PDG cutout of the values of the proton radius as listed before 2010. So these are experiments done, I don't know what happened, with various techniques before about 2010. So you see that the scattering experiments are generally give the higher values after, I don't know, the 70s or so. And the spectroscopy measurements tend to give, let me see here now. The spectroscopy measurements and the co-data values are a little bit lower. And there are some theoretical reanalyses of the data which also generally give high values, except the dispersion analysis at the top there. It's the beep after when I use the pointer, so I think this is the unfortunate. I haven't installed software or something. So there are two developments in 2010. Yeah, I can turn off my, there we go, thanks. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the speaker, the group speaker.
No, but you must be connecting your sound somehow to the...
Nope, it's just through the display port, which I don't think has sound. So.
I think it does.
Oh, it does? Okay, well. Yeah, okay. Well, hopefully it's not too annoying. Okay, so two developments in 2010. One was, where is it? I'd rather use that. Oh, okay. This will be a good backup. Okay, one is a high statistics and precision EP scattering measurement that was done at Mainz by the A1 collaboration, and the second was a new spectroscopic analysis by a group at the Paul Scherrer Institute in Switzerland, and that used muonic hydrogen. So just a recall of quantum mechanics, where the proton radius comes in the hydrogen energy spectrum. So the first is the well-known Bohr type, 1/n² term in the energy levels, and the second is the so-called finite size contribution. So you see two things. It's the proton radius appears as here, and the reduced mass appears to the cubic power in this term as well. And so the well-measured 1s2 s transition is dependent both on the Rydberg constant and on the proton charge radius. And the finite size contribution can be separated by either measuring another atomic hydrogen transition. By measuring it using an electron-proton scattering experiment, or by measuring another transition in a similar physical system, at PSI they used a muonic hydrogen, and this was the 2s to 2p transition. And in muonic hydrogen, since the reduced mass is about 10 to the 2 greater, and the reduced mass cubed is 7 orders of magnitude greater, the effect of the finite size is enhanced by the smaller Bohr radius. So this is one slide on the on spectroscopy. So this muonic hydrogen is excited with a laser to this metastable 2s state, to the 2p state, I'm sorry. And this has a lifetime of about 1 microsecond after the formation of these muonic hydrogen atoms. If this laser on resonance, then these 2 keV emitted photons are detected in coincidence with the laser. In the level splitting, the vacuum polarization is dominant, but the proton radius again has an effect that goes as a reduced mass cubed, and the effect is about 2% from muonic hydrogen. So the energy level shift is given by this formula below, where RE is in femtometers. And so the plot above shows the value or the laser frequency that they detected in resonance, and for comparison, if you took the codata value of the proton charge radius or the EP scattering measurement, the resonance line would appear elsewhere. So in electron-proton scattering, this is a sort of well-known and formalism, the Mach cross-section with for a relativistic electron scattering off a recoiling point-like proton has been known for many years, many decades. And the Rosenbluth formula generalizes the above when you have a non-point-like proton. And so this is given in terms of two form factors. In this formalism, normally one uses the SOX form factors, which are related to the well-known Dirac and Pauli form factors you would see, say, in Peskin and Schroeder by these formulas here, where tau is the momentum exchange divided by 4 times the mass of the heavy particle, so here the proton mass squared. And using this definition of the vertex, the radii are defined by the first derivative of the of these form factors. Wow, that's really loud. Of the form factors. Of the form factors at q squared equals to 0, when the momentum transfer is 0. And so at q squared equals to 0, the values of these form factors are for the electric form factor, just 1, i.e. the charge of the proton, and for the magnetic form factor, the anomalous magnetic moment. Okay, so since 2010, this is sort of what the state of the proton charge radius measurements look like. So at the top here, you have these the codata value, a 2011 measurement from a collaboration at JLab, the Mainz experiment, the A1, and then this reanalysis by Ingo Sick at Basel, I believe. And so these are the EP scattering measurements up here, and the electronic hydrogen spectroscopic measurement here. And below here, we have the two measurements, one from 2010 and an updated one in 2013 from the PSI groups. And so the discrepancy is coded as 7 sigma, which you could also say, if you flipped it around and said, look, maybe it's not a problem with the proton charge radius, it's a problem with the Rydberg constant, you would get an equally disturbing discrepancy as well, because the Rydberg constant is one of the most well-measured ones in nature. And so in this paper, our goal was to perform a reanalysis of the EP scattering data and simultaneously fit the magnetic and charge radii for the proton. Do you mean the spectroscopy guys? No, so that previous, Richard and Gill investigated that in a previous paper, but no, our goal here was just the scattering.
Because, I mean, even if you find a way to reduce the discrepancy in the scattering, I mean, what do you say about the discrepancy in the, I mean, the large part of the discrepancy is coming from the spectroscopic measurement.
Right, so the difficult thing is that, you know, as phenomenologists, we don't know anything about the experimental uncertainties in the spectroscopic measurements. And the theory uncertainties for these bound state type calculations, they usually scale as 1 over the mass. So you would expect the theoretical uncertainties from, say, radiative corrections in the muonic system to be actually even smaller than those in the electronic system. So unless, I think there have been attempts since 2010 to reanalyze the theoretical uncertainties in the electronic hydrogen spectroscopy, but we weren't a part of that.
So far there hasn't been any real progress in trying to understand what tolerance of the spectroscopic.
No. I mean, so Richard and Gill, as I'll show you in the next section, for these form factor, for the form factor part of the previous analyses, if you use a form factor that, you know, agrees with QCD, et cetera, I think the spectroscopy measurements, it didn't vary enough to bring it down to agreement with muonic hydrogen. So my last motivation slide. The EP scattering system you can view as a more simple system for the neutrino program. So for example, on the right here, this would be a signal process at LBNE. And the assumptions and tools that are used in the nuclear community for the EP scattering also sort of appear in sometimes even more simplified forms in the neutrino scattering community. And we, as we know, the United States is spending $1 billion or is focusing much of their future effort, maybe for the next decade or so, in the neutrinos. So it's critical for us to be able to understand what's going on in these systems theoretically and to make sure that we're interpreting these results correctly. So in this analysis, we've considered data with a maximum momentum transfer of 1 GeV squared, and we've split the available elastic EP scattering data into two data sets. One is the MINDS data set, which was taken in 2006 and 2007, and the first results were announced in 2010. This is very high statistics, 1422 data points. And the full data set lies with Q squared below 1 GeV squared. In comparison, the world data set is a compilation of sort of all these data, all the data from experiments you saw, say, in the first slide that I showed. And for data below 1 GeV squared, we get 363 data points. And there's also 43 polarization measurements, which use a different kinematic technique to directly measure the form factor ratio mu times GE over GM. So that's sort of a comparison of what the statistics look like between the two data sets. And just as an aside, for all our fitting, we've used a SciPy. So now I'll move on to our description of the form factors. So the cross sections for these experiments, again, for a non-point like proton, the form factors, the SOX electric and magnetic form factors appear as above. And earlier analyses used very simple functional forms for these form factors. They either use polynomials, inverse polynomials, and continued fractions. Some of these were motivated by, say, the long distance at large momentum transfers. These form factors behave sort of like dipoles. However, for a lot of these, it was found that there was pathological behavior as one higher order terms in the expansion. So in any sort of realistic analysis, one truncates this expansion, so the infinity here, becomes some K max. Previously, Richard Hill and Gil Paz looked at some of these form factors and found that you didn't get stable behavior as one went to increase in K max. So this was motivation to look at different form factors.
So basically, like, why should K-max matter in this case, right? Because you're looking at the behavior in Q squared equal to zero, which is dominated by...
Right, but one would think that as you include higher K-max, these expansions should be stable,
right,
if they are well-behaved.
That's what I'm saying, like, why should it be unstable?
So that's one thing I'll show in the next slide that maybe might help. So one thing is that you do... The data is taken at some finite momentum transfer. So although you're really interested in the radius, for the radius, you're interested in the values at near Q squared equals to zero. That's simply the experiments don't go to that low Q squared. So if you look at what QCD says, well, it constrains the form factors to be analytic outside of some time-like cut beginning at the 2 pi on production threshold. Now, clearly this presents an issue with for expansions that you just are simply polynomials in Q squared. So what you can do instead is use a conformal map, complex variables, to obtain a true small expansion variable for the physical region. So you map the time-like cut, this branch cut, to the unit circle, and the rest of the Argand diagram gets mapped to the interior of that unit circle. And so these conformal maps take these types of forms. Now, what you get is a true, the z always is less than or equal to 1, so you now have a variable that will guarantee a convergent expansion if the coefficients don't become, are not poorly behaved. Now, the variables appearing here, Q squared max is just the maximum momentum transfer for any given set of data. T0 is the point that in the t-plane that is mapped to zero here in the z-plane. And we've used the simple choice T0 equals to 0, but we have checked that using a different value for T0 does not significantly affect the results. And by including other data, such as photo production of nuclei or pion data, you can move T-cut from the 2-pion production threshold up to a higher value, which improves the convergence of the expansion. So it allows you to tighten this the range that is mapped to the Z-plane here, which means that you theoretically could go to a smaller K-max in order to obtain good convergence. So here I've shown the sensitivity of the statistical uncertainties to Q-squared max. So scattering data at low Q-squared determines the radius, since it's defined as the slope at Q-squared equals to 0. So the spot's a little bit busy, but the filled circles are the, or the filled points are the data from the Mainz experiment, and the hollow points are the data from this world, world data set. The electric radius uncertainties are here, and the magnetic radius uncertainties are here. So you see that at very low Q squared, you still have very large statistical errors, but as you go to, say, around 0.5 or higher, these statistical errors flatten out. So if you just simply plug in a bounded Z expansion and fit to the data again, you get behavior that looks like this. So in this plot here, I plotted Q squared max on the bottom. So here I'm only taking data in the Mainz data set up to 0.1 GV squared or 0.5, et cetera. And on the vertical axis, the radii values. So you see that these radii values are not constant depending on whether you take a subset of the data, but they vary quite dramatically, all the way up to around 0.5 GV squared and even higher than that. Correct. Yeah.
Have you tried it in reverse?
So only using the higher Q squared data?
Right. You start, let's say, from not go all the way, because that's not sensible, but let's say from Q squared 1 down to 0.5 and see how that varies.
No, we haven't we haven't done that. That would that would significantly decrease the statistics. So for example, at 0.5, you already include about 1,280 of the points out of 1,422, so you'd only be left with, so for the points in this range, you'd be only left with about 140 points, which would really decrease your statistical power.
So I should think of the plot on the last slide that's telling me what the error bars are on the,
yes,
the
correct.
Error bars on this plot?
Yeah, correct.
So, and that was also Qmax, right?
Yes.
So if you drew error bars on those plots, do they actually look inconsistent? Like, is that consistent with just being a statistical artifact or not?
So, I mean, for example, here, if you take the entire data set, it's about one sigma inconsistent with the 0.5.
Oh, sorry, actually, are your three lines supposed to
know? Yeah,
okay.
Correct.
Those are the
errors. There are, yeah, they
okay,
are the
errors.
Yeah, sorry if that was confusing.
Okay, so yeah, so there's definitely some systematic discrepancy between
the low Q squared.
But it would, I do kind of agree with you, Ty. It would be simplest, like, to look at the very low Q squared data and everything except the low Q squared data, so that they're statistically independent.
Right.
And, you know, maybe going from 0.2 to 1.
Yeah. There is, that's a good point. We do have a follow-up for some of the form factors, a paper that's in progress, so that's something I can definitely suggest. On the right, just as a sanity check, these are the cross-sections themselves. It's really cross-section ratio normalized to the cross-section from a dipole form factor, as given in, by the A1 collaboration. And these points are just color-coded as they've been taken for different spectrometers in the experiment. And the green line, if it's visible here, it might be a little bit faint, is our value, is what our form factor looks like plotted on top of the data. And you see it goes through the points quite well, and it doesn't look like there's any sort of systematically biased upwards or downwards from the data.
So the first three plots?
Oh, sorry. These six subplots here, the A1 experiment has six beam energies, and this is just the data plotted from these different beam energies.
Do you understand why there is so much spread at different energies and little spread? Like, what if the spread changes with energy?
So do you mean the size of the error bars? The y-axes also differ considerably. So this data at low energy, this is 180 MeV. This is the maximum, or this is the highest beam energy at 855 MeV. And I think this is just the, this is the, for example, this ratio becomes much higher at the at larger angles for the high energy.
I mean, the biggest, the highest one, you have a lot of spread throughout, right?
I think you have to compare the size of the error bars.
Yeah, these error bars are four. Right.
But the y-axis is not very different, right? Like 1 to 1 compared to 1.
No, this
right.
is this goes this is a say 0.3 difference, and this is 0.04.
Yeah, so the top one, the error bars are like 0.015.
Yeah.
And the bottom one, 0.015 error bar looks like nothing, right?
So we haven't massaged the data here. This is really the raw. These points here are the raw data that have been given to us by the experiment.
But I would say that the small scattering angle, on some of the energies at least, the small scattering angle data doesn't seem to fit your curve that well. But like certainly not the bottom plot. That's like your curve is just grazing the top of the error bars, and
right.
they seem to have a systematically different shape. So maybe that's related to the effect you were just talking about on the left.
Yeah, so I guess, it would be possible to blow this up. This was sort of just to compare with what the, it's two similar plots that the collaboration showed in one of its figures, but yeah, this is by no means sort of our final take on this.
Is this public data?
The circles, you mean this data? Yes, it's public. Yeah, and it's also included as a supplement in our paper.
This
data, right on this plot, is data they provided to us. So you can download it also from their paper. And so just to give you numbers, if I take the entire data set, the radius value that we obtain simply by using a form factor that is that theoretically agrees with QCD is 0.92 femtometers with an error of 0.009, and the magnetic radius is 0.743. So this is the electric radius value is considerably higher than that given by the A1 collaboration and the codata value. And the magnetic radius, I believe, agrees within one sigma with the A1 collaborations. And again, I should emphasize these are only statistics, only errors. We haven't done any sort of correlated error analysis here. Or sorry, systematic error analysis here. Yes, correct. Yeah, so in the next three sections, we'll analyze why that might possibly be. So just some checks here. So I talked about that K-max, which we truncate the expansion for the form factor. And this is just to show that using a bounded expansion, on the expansion that where the coefficients are bounded in the form factor, that the Kmax after a certain value matters very little to the final results. So on the bottom here, I plotted Kmax from 4 to 12. And you see that the fit has essentially converged for Kmax equals to 10. And we've gone and used a default of Kmax equals to 12 in our fits. Similarly, there have been recent analyses by a group in Bonn that took the Z expansion, but did not bound the coefficients, so allowed them to fluctuate wildly in conflict with QCD. So if we enlarge this bound to something sort of unreasonable, say a million or 10 to the 7 or something like this, we see that we get wildly varying values of the radii, and the errors become very large as one goes to larger Kmax. So here, for bounds that are enormous, you can get a small radius. However, the uncertainties grow very large. I'll move on to talking about the radiative corrections in these that are how they are implemented in these experiments and what we've looked at. So To the level of precision that these experiments can probe, we do require one loop order alpha radiative corrections. And these proton form factors are defined in the so-called one loop, one photon exchange approximation. And a consistent definition of these form factors is needed to compare the radii. And this not only applies between scattering experiments, it also applies when one is comparing the scattering and the spectroscopic experiments. So all these diagrams here, we know how to compute in perturbation theory, except for the box one, this two-photon exchange. So the electron vertex and the leptonic contributions to the vacuum polarization are well known. Previous dispersive analysis of the E plus to E minus to hadrons data shows that the correction from hadronic vacuum polarization is definitely below the current precision in these scattering experiments. For the soft Bremsstrahlung and the two-photon exchange, one defines conventions to subtract infrared divergences, and there's two popular ones in the literature. The World dataset has generally used Psi in the past, and the A1 collaboration uses the so-called Max Born and John prescription. And again, at present, we can't calculate the remainder of this TP contribution from first principles. So the finite TPE, these finite TPE corrections are then generally estimated by this standard procedure of sticking in form factors. So one draws the Feynman diagrams with the intermediate proton propagating as a Dirac particle, and you simply insert a vertex at each of the proton-photon vertices. Using
from an effective field theory point of view, that doesn't make any sense, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, one could use Wilson coefficients for these vertices in an effective field theory expansion. Correct. Exactly. Yes. But this is what has been done in the literature in the past, so this is what I'm showing here.
No, you can also measure this process, right, in Compton scattering at some level.
Right. Right, and there's also, yes, correct. Although there's also sort of virtual, there's also attempts to relate these, the Wilson coefficients and the effective theory to sort of so-called virtual Compton scattering as well. Yeah, correct. So that would be another step, that would be another approach to considering these TP, and we have talked about that as well. So, if one does this and uses simple form factor assumptions for F1 and F2, for example, monopoles or dipoles, or the so-called sum of monopoles that was written down in 2005 and then used extensively since, these are the popular models in literature, and that's what we've compared against. The A1 collaboration instead applied something called the McKinley-Feshbach correction, which in the Q squared equals to zero limit is this so-called Coulomb distortion first computed by Rosenfelder in 1999. And this can also be understood as the scattering of soft photons in this in the infinite heavy particle limit. So if we do that and we apply different finite TP corrections to our existing or to our previous analysis, we get varying behavior as such. So if we took no finite TP correction, we simply canceled the infrared divergences with the soft Bremsstrahlung diagram, then we get a very different behavior. This differs by probably about 0.02 femtometers. However, any finite TP correction that's added doesn't considerably vary in terms of the difference between their effects when you compare them against each other. So the Feshbach is the black curve here, and the dipole is the green curve, which almost exactly follows the Feshbach curve. And the Blunden sum of monopoles is the blue curve here, which has been used in the past, or used popularly since it was published. And since...
Before you added the one-loop contribution, you find a result of 0.92.
Yes, correct.
So now you're saying when I add all the finite one-loop contribution except for a TPE, then I can go down to
about 0.9. Yeah.
And then if I add the TPEs, then I get back to 0.92.
Yeah, correct. So the existing analyses would be the black curve here. Yeah. So just a, an, some further information. This would be the behavior for different TPE correction models. This is a comparison of the finite correction at q squared equals to 0.5 g v squared for different scattering angles. So epsilon going to 0 here is backscattering, and epsilon going to 1 is forward scattering. And so for larger q squared values, you see that the Blunden and the Blunden correction, which is black here on this curve, on this plot, actually changes sign. It goes negative instead of positive. And this is actually the behavior that has been noticed in the past that is required to resolve the discrepancy in the world data set between so-called Rosenbluth type measurements and the polarization measurements of the ratio. And this has been noted since, I believe, the early 2000s. The discrepancy in the form factor ratios between these two types of measurements. Okay, so now we'll talk about these, the uncorrelated and the constant systematics in these experiments. In the A1 analysis, they grouped the data set into 18 subsets. So there are three spectrometers and six beam energies. And for each subset, the differences between the fit and the measured cross-sections are scaled by the uncertainties are fit to a Gaussian. And this width of the Gaussian is used as a scaling factor for the statistical uncertainties in the subset. What they find is a reduced chi-squared after this procedure of about 1.15. And we found a similar reduced chi-squared just using the bounded set expansion fit as well. Not taking this Gaussian, but simply dividing the chi-squared that we get for each subset divided by the number of points in that subset. So if you sort of naively say that the scaling factor times the uncertainty for any given point is equal to the quadrature sum of the statistical uncertainties and the uncorrelated systematics, then these uncorrelated systematics for some of the points are as low as 0.05%. And in fact, since in the A1 experiment, they take multiple data points at the same kinematic settings, that actually drives the systematic uncertainties even lower. And it's well known that in these types of experiments, the random and time-dependent variations are really difficult to constrain below about 0.1% even. So in the A1 analysis, there are certain systematics that are not accounted for explicitly. So time-dependent efficiencies, rate variations, beam energy uncertainties, and sort of offsets in the spectrometer angle. And we would expect if you took identical measurements for the same kinematics that these uncertainties would be identical. So if one did the naive thing and simply added a fixed systematic to account for all these things, you would underestimate the systematic error because you would be doing it for each of these data points. So what we decided to do in our analysis is to combine these identical data points first, and then add the fixed systematic. So what we've done is first removed just one set of points with inconsistent scatter. This was 3 points in the full data set. And then identify 407 kinematic settings that had multiple data points. And then we rebin these to obtain a smaller data set of 657 points.
So each data point is an angle and an energy?
Do you mean the final kinematic variables? We've used the q squared, the momentum transfer, and the energy as well.
Sorry, I think you said it. No, angle is corresponding to the q squared, right? So
correct.
So you chose q squared.
Yeah, instead of angle, correct.
Okay, energy.
Yeah.
So it's a two-dimensional distribution.
Yeah.
So did you try to just glob all the data and run a classification algorithm on it to see whether you have like really differing classes of data points?
Uh-huh. So would you, if you did that, would you sort of would you plot them by, if you color-coded them by spectrometer or other things? Because there are sort of some of these data points, even though they might have identical kinematics, have different experimental setups as well. You know, they were taken with a different spectrometer or a different, yeah. In a different run. So the A1 collaboration has been pretty careful to sort of separate out all these experimental, experimental sort of aspects of the data. So after rebidding, we've investigated the effect of adding a 0.25% and a 0.3% fixed systematic. So what that means is for the new uncertainty becomes the old unscaled, a quadrant sum of the old unscaled uncertainty and a 0.3 or 0.25% fixed systematic for the cross-section. And here are the 18 subsets we talked about here. And the number of data points is in the third column here. In these two columns is the result of the reduced chi-squared and the confidence level when one adds a 0.25% systematic, and the last two columns when one adds a 0.3% systematic. In particular, one subset, the one at 855 MeV for the beam energy and with spectrometer B, has a very large reduced chi-squared still, even after adding either 0.25 or 0.3. So what we did instead is, for this particular subset, added a 0.4% uncorrelated systematic to try to bring down the reduced chi-squared to near one. And so when we fit the rebin data set after these two modifications, we find that we have a lower radius value by more than one sigma from the previous result, and the uncertainty increased by about 50%. And the magnetic radius similarly goes up, and the uncertainty as well goes up by, I think it's around the same order, by about 40 to 50%. And lastly, before showing results, I'll talk about the correlated systematics, which was is probably the most difficult part of this analysis. Again, in the A1 approach, there's three additional quantities for each cross-section point. There are two cross-sections corresponding to the variations in the Bremsstrahlung energy cut, so this is an acceptance variation. And the second is a kinematic dependent factor, which is linear in the scattering angle, and is supposed to account for various experimental uncertainties like efficiency changes or normalization drifts or background misestimations. And the procedure that they outline is you refit the entire data set using either the minimum or maximum acceptances, so that either one of the two cross-sections, or you divide or multiply the central values of the cross-sections by this linear factor. And so when you do that, the largest differences of the resulting fit from sort of your central values is summed in quadrature to get your correlated systematic error. So firstly, the easy thing is simply the acceptance. And we find that the energy cut actually has very little difference on the error. You only get an uncertainty of about 0.003 femtometers for the electric radius and less than 0.01 femtometers for the magnetic radius. So the acceptance variation is quite small. So with this kinematic dependent factor, we decide to investigate a little bit more closely what with some more variations, this procedure. So the linear factor that one would multiply or divide a cross-section by is given here. So X is any sort of kinematic variable in question, and the minimum and maximum are the ranges over any given subset for this kinematic variable. And A is just some small factor one would assume that represents the maximum sort of correlated systematic error that might be in a subset. So in the A1 analysis, according to this formula, X is equal to theta. There are 18 values for the theta max and theta min for each subset, spectrometer beam energy subset. And this linear factor is about 0.2%. And it's also the same sign for all the subsets. So instead, we investigated a similar formula, except we used many different kinematic variables, such as a 1 over theta, or q squared, or the final energy of the electron. And we've also taken three different groupings. We looked at just the spectrometers, which would be three groupings, the same as the Mainz analysis did, and also just the all the normalizations. So this would be all sort of the different runs that the A1 collaboration did, you know, in different time periods, with different spectrometers, different beam energies. And there are 34 of these subgroups. And in addition, we've taken A to be much larger to represent sort of what we think is a more realistic estimate of what the size of the correlated systematics would be, and that's 0.5%. We've also taken them to be the same sign just because the number of combinations would be very large if one were to start varying that. And so different variables that we've shown here, these different x kinematic variables, modify the functional form of the correction within the subset. However, the endpoints will always be fixed to have a correction of 0 or 0.5%. Okay, so our findings for selection of these variables, in this case for the spectrometer e-beam combination, are shown here. So generally, these are about a factor of 2.5 bigger than the A1 analysis, and this is mainly due to the increase in the magnitude of the of that linear factor. Now, different variable choices generally yield similar results. However, we found the largest range for this 1 over Q squared choice of the kinematic variable. So here, 1 over Q squared yields, for a very small Q squared, one would expect a large difference, so about almost 0.05 femtometers. But even for the entire data set, still lies about 0.02 femtometers, which is considerable. So other sort of qualitative aspects of our findings, the normalization grouping yielded uncertainties that were typically larger for the electric radius, but smaller for the magnetic radius compared to the default subgrouping. The smaller grouping of just the spectrometers yielded the opposite results. So smaller uncertainties for the electric radius, but bigger ones for the magnetic radius. Now, the systematic effects could differ for the different spectrometers, which is why choosing the same sign for all subgroupings is a little bit suspect. And the combined effect can be enhanced or suppressed depending on whether these corrections are actually identical. So for example, for the magnetic radius, we found some instances where you obtain cancellations between the different spectrometers when the linear correction was applied to all spectrometers versus each spectrometer individually. So for example, if you only applied the correction, this linear factor, to all data points from spectrometer A or B, you got a cancellation in if you summed these different corrections compared to doing all three at once. And so just for representative sake, for our final results, we took also theta with twice a linear factor that was about twice as big as the Mainz analysis, and we divided the corrections we obtained by about 4/5. And so for the entire data set, this yield correlated systematic uncertainties of 0.014 femtometers and 0.02 for the electric and the magnetic radius. So I've thrown a lot at you in the last three sections, so I just want to summarize what our different steps have done to the radius value we found so far. So the Crema analysis, the muonic hydrogen is this line all the way here to the left. The co-data range is here, and the default A1 analysis value is here, and you can see the results of our analysis in these four points here. So the first was just simply choosing the correct form factor that obeys QCD. The second was taking a slightly different TPE correction, which we saw has not that big of an effect. The rebinning and the larger uncorrelated systematic uncertainty shifts the value down, and then the correlated systematics increases the error bar here. So what we found finally is a radius value of 0.908. The first is the statistical and uncorrelated uncertainty. The second uncertainty is from the energy cut, which was small, as I said, and the third is from the correlated systematic. So you see that this is still far away from the muonic hydrogen value, and it's even still more than a sigma away from the co-data value. So if one were to try to reconcile these values, one would need sort of a larger correlated systematic, and that you could investigate a range of corrections larger than 0.4%, but then you know that the experimenters might already cry foul at that. You could try a more extreme functional form, or you could investigate really what the effect of was for a tuned cancellation between these subsets in the systematics.
I thought the original Mainz data agreed with the magnetic radius result. Do you agree with the magnetic radius result?
The magnetic radius result for what? Sorry.
I thought the original data, well, their...
I haven't plotted it on magnetic radius here, but I have it later.
Okay. But do you know the answer for that?
But which...
So for A1 data, I think that's the original Mainz analysis, right?
Yeah, correct.
I thought they showed that, yes, they get the wrong, well, compared to muonics, they get high radius, electric radius,
uh-huh.
But the magnetic radius agreed with prior determinations from
I think that's although their value was low, I believe, compared to previous results. But you'll, I have a summary slide for our, for the magnetic radius. But I believe, well, what you'll see is that the errors are fairly large in the magnetic radius. So I mean, I think there were some previous determinations of the magnetic radius that were above 0.8 femtometers. So that's why I'm hesitant to say that they agreed, because I can't remember exactly. And I don't know, I can't remember who's done reanalyses
so
for the magnetic radius.
Magnetic radius.
It's a simultaneous fit to the data for the electric and form factors, and they're just extracted the same way.
Right, but how does your result compare to their result?
Oh, it's within one sigma, so theirs was 7. You'll see it on a later slide, I can't remember the exact value. Okay, one last thing is one could also try as an independent check a fit to the data, but also floating not only the normalizations of the different subsets, but also the slope parameters for each of the subsets. And we tested this using a fit with a Gaussian error on these slope parameters with the normalization grouping. So what we found actually was results that were similar to the analysis. So these two columns are for this, this sort of new fit, or this independent fit. And these were the existing results I showed on the previous slide for two different values of the Q-squared max. And the uncertainties in this fit are somewhat smaller for the charge radius and larger for the magnetic radius. So this would be in line with the expectation that if the previous analysis was seeing a cancellation in the uncertainties for the magnetic radius, that an independent fit would find a larger correlated systematic for the magnetic radius, and that's what we see here. Now, this could be an equally unrealistic assumption, you know, that all these correlated systematics are completely independent for each of these subsets. However, if we did a combined fit with the Mainz data and the world data sets, we would likely require this procedure because the world data set already has the correlated systematics in the uncertainties and they can't be separated out. Okay, so lastly, I'll go to the results. These were similar plots as before, except for all our new, except for our analyses. And you see you still have this funny behavior or this disagreement between subsets of the data and low Q-squared and large Q-squared data. And just to remind you, this was with the following parameter choices. So T naught equals to 0, a K-max of 12, and a bound of 5 on the parameters. So when we revisit the sensitivity plot I showed before, now we want to maximize the sensitivity but to the radius, but minimize the effect of possible high Q-squared systematics. And what this plot is showing is that around 0.5 GeV squared, the statistical uncertainties sort of flatten. So that would be a good choice to cut off the inclusion of the data in order not to be possibly biased by what's going on at high Q squared. And if we do that, then we get summary plots like the following. So this is these first few values I showed before. The final value that we determined for the Mainz data set is shown in this blue circle here. The world data, we've taken a slightly larger value of Q squared max, and it's given in this triangle here, with a naive average that's still 4.2 sigma away from the muonic hydrogen value, which is not 7 sigma, so it's an improvement. However, there is there's still sort of what you might call an alarming discrepancy. So I took this previous analysis here, and what I did is cut off the, I took the value instead at 0.5 GeV squared, so this value here.
Why?
Because I wanted to minimize, I wanted to max, to see where the statistical uncertainties flatline, but minimize my exposure to high Q-squared systematics from the data. It's a similar choice. It's also to compare to what Richard and Gill did previously when they analyzed just the form factor ratios.
I guess I'm just confused. So they're saying that the result in Z expansion is also yours, right?
Correct, before we reconsidered all the
systematics,
et cetera.
So you're saying what you have is Mainz final is the Z expansion plus considering all the system optics.
Correct. And
making the choice that Q squared equals 0.5.
Yes.
Yeah. And world data is doing all of that on all the world data?
Correct. Yeah, with, well, the analysis of the uncorrelated and the correlated systematics has already been done previously and starting in about 2007 by John and some of his collaborators. Similarly for the magnetic radius, this was the plot I wanted to allude to before. The A1 analysis is over here. Similar to what I showed previously, the steps when we reanalyze the data are shown here, and our final results are here. Now here, the MINDS and the world data are 2.7 sigma discrepant, as opposed to within agreement here for the electric radius. So this is still something that needs to be looked into. And our final, as a result, our final naive average is fairly high, I believe, compared to the compared to the A1 result. So one possible resolution while we were thinking about this is that if we include scattering data with momentum transfers as large as a GeV squared, in this regime, QED perturbation theory can break down because you have large logarithms from the electron radiative corrections. So this alpha over pi log squared factor between Q squared and ME and the electron mass squared is about 0.5. And if we recall the sum of the first order vacuum polarization and electron vertex and real Bremsstrahlung corrections, it has sort of this form for the leading logs, where eta is just a recoil factor, so you can ignore that, and delta E is the detector energy resolution. Now, when the momentum transfer and the energies, the beam energies and the final energies of the electrons, and the detector energy resolution is about the scale of the electron mass, the leading series of logarithms are resummed as in this procedure, as outlined by Yeni and collaborators in a paper from 1961. And this is sort of the framework that's been used since then, and I think modified a little by, say, Vanderhagen and some other collaborators since, for the recent analyses. But in practice, if the detector energy resolution is much bigger than the electron mass, we have an additional scale in the experiment. And so as a check, what we can do is instead resum simply the double logarithm as an exponential. And if this were true, this should really give the same result as the existing analyses. But instead, what we find is that if we take, say, our data, after rebinning and adding the fixed systematics, and we take a detector energy of about 10 MeV, we get fairly large shifts we get fairly large uncertainty bands in the result. So, let me go back. Yeah. So sorry. This is the black is the existing plot I showed at the first slide of this section, and the blue curves now are just when I divide by, let me go back, by this factor, which should yield the same one loop radiative corrections. And we do see that the uncertainty bands are much larger in this case. And even for, say, around 0.5 GeV squared, approach the muonic hydrogen value. So this is being investigated right now, I think by Richard in a more formal paper, I believe. So I would advise people to stay tuned.
It seems like the central value is the same, you're just expanding the error values.
Yes, correct. But I mean, if this is not taken into account when applying radiative corrections to existing analyses, then one is underestimating the error.
Yeah, I agree. It's not a very satisfying resolution of this.
No, it's not satisfying at all. But, or it's not anything that's going to allow for new physics or something, say, yeah.
Well, or any kind of resolution of this whole business, right? Because you still have the hypogenic measurements. They're still a 5 sigma discrepant.
Though one could say that one could, if the logs are also not being taken into account carefully in those analyses as well? Because everything's at low scale, yes, correct. Yeah.
Oh, you could discarded for other reasons, right? You can say, you know, it's a bunch of measurements that no one of them is more than 2 sigma, so something is systematically wrong. But you could do that if the EP measurements would seem to converge into something sensible, but that doesn't seem to be the case either. Like, you get the findings that actually things are worse than what the mind's original claim.
Yes.
Which is...
Okay, so to conclude, I've presented a new comprehensive analysis of the existing EP scattering data using form factors constrained by QCD, performing careful studies of these existing radiative correction models, and examining the uncorrelated systematics and reconsidering the systematic uncertainties. The MINDS and the world values for the electric radius are consistent, but a simple combination of the MINDS and the world values remains about 4 sigma away from the spectroscopic value for muonic hydrogen. We do find a 2.7 sigma difference in the MINDS and world values for the magnetic radius, which remains to be resolved. Though a possible resolution of this discrepancy involves modifying the large log resummation of the one-loop radiative corrections in these analyses by considering intermediate energy scales that are neglected in the existing standard analyses. So in the future, there will be more experiments. There's additional low Q-squared measurements for EP scattering at JLab and by the A1 collaboration. There's also scattering of muons off protons at PSI, and this is the MUSE collaboration. There's further work in the spectroscopy groups, and also that should be next generation lattice QCD. In terms of new physics, people have been writing papers, including people here, have been writing papers on this for some years now. Proposed have been flavor-conserving non-universal interactions, parity-violating muonic forces, and also new force carriers between protons and muons. So I think the puzzle, even though the number of sigma is lessened, is still very much there, and I think all new possible explanations should be investigated. Thanks.
Well, I think it's fair to say that all the new physics proposals are shit.
This is a really big diplomatic.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really puzzling situation, right? I mean,
yeah, I think it's, and not only for this community, but also, you know, if.
Scattering, and this result is just even more confusing than anything.
Why didn't you like the log? I don't understand why you didn't like about the log resolution. Suppose it's true that they're right about the log.
Well, because there are quite a few other experiments that seem to suggest a high value. So you're just saying that this experiment is not resolving it. It's not like nothing is going in the direction of a small radius. You're just finding reasons to think that there are large enough.
So the fact that there could have been large theoretical errors in all the predictions for what R is
good enough. Yeah, it's still, the central boundary is still far away. If you average everything, it's still several, quite a few sigmas away. It's not like a 2 sigma in one. Even with all these gymnastics, you're still 4 sigma away.
Presumably, it's just that if you're right with the logs, you can then do better and reduce that error, right?
I think so, with a more careful analysis, yeah. So I should point out, but if you just took the MINDS analysis with the error bars after our reanalysis, it's now actually 3 sigma away from the muonic hydrogen value, so it's even less. The combination with the world data is further away, but just our sort of final MINDS value is only 3 sigma away. So, you know, if you were to only sort of take the data from the state-of-the-art experiment and do our reanalysis of it, you're doing even better in some sense.
I think, you know, it's doing better in the sense that a lot of us did better when we got the wrong answer in our undergraduate lab classes, right?
Right.
Oh, well, all, you know, all large the error bars, so that it's only 2 sigma. I did that, but I sort of knew that I wasn't doing, you know.
The errors of all us, yeah. My name is Natalia.
I think as well, we haven't heard back from the collaboration, but there probably needs to be sort of before the experimental analyses go through, I think there probably needs to be increasing collaboration between the theorists or phenomenologists and the experimentalists before sort of all these, you know, the experimenters publish the results as well. Because we could avoid confusion in all these results maybe if both the experimenters were more careful when considering all the theoretical aspects of the analysis, and the theorists had, you know, more direct access to what was going on in the experiment before everyone just rushes to release the result.
Do you have an example of that statement?
I would hope that's what would go on in the future, you know, in these future experiments.
What is a specific example where the experimenters could have benefited from talking to the theorists?
So, I can give it one, that's the other way around. Maybe, I don't know if that will be helpful, but the A1 analysis, when it looks at, for example, the radiative correction, it actually employs something which uses also a Monte Carlo for the radiative tail, et cetera. And it's outlined in the A1 paper, but I haven't really met a theorist that understands it at all. And it's sort of a closed source code or procedure. And we've asked them about it, but it's still very confusing to us. And that makes comparisons difficult, too, if you're sort of just doing a reanalysis of what they're doing.
Is that the assumption seems to be that if you do a bit, supposing you're right and you do a better job of reducing that error, the central value doesn't have to stay the same, right? Why can't it be that when you do that,
this is not the only result, right? Like, there are quite a few other results from hydrogenic measurements.
But they're not subject to this error, you think.
Right, and they all, everything is high. So, like, I could give you a reason why I would ignore the hydrogenic measurements, but I would do it if those measurements tend to be in a low central value that I could start, you know, swallowing them. But none of those things that I would allow myself give me something that is anywhere close to the non-neutral hydrogen. So if I really have to do all these gymnastics and get Sir Sigma away, that's pretty unsatisfying.
But how do you know that implicit in that is that this error that you're talking about isn't also applying to all of it?
No, it's not. It's very little, very, very different.
So you're saying that in the atomic ones, you don't have the Lewis-Lenz paradox?
You might have other things.
Yeah, the large, there's no momentum transfers as large as GeV squared in the spectroscopic measurements.
So it's just that if you look at all of it together, it just seems like, you know, one would have hoped that maybe the electron proton scattering after some thought and some reanalysis will start converging. I think there was even some paper by Carlson or someone who claimed that if they do the feat, they get a very small value for it.
Right, so that they did, I think Carlson did what you were talking about at the very, or what you asked about at the very beginning of the talk, where why do we need such large Kmax? All we need is, say, one or two if we're only interested at low, very, very low Q squared. But again, that I think I've talked about that here. Yeah.
So you see,
I've heard hour long talks on this, and I just say, well, it shouldn't matter, right?
Yeah.
Because.
So the 4.2 sigma discrepancy now only includes the world average if you're talking about EP scattering. That doesn't include the hydrogenic stuff.
No, none of the spectroscopy. Which I think would, well, if you look at the co-data, right, would tend to move it lower.
So if you go back to your sort of variant Qmax curves, the final version of them, yeah. So is it fair to say that, I mean, my naive interpretation of, say, the fact that there are still these two sigma discrepancies as you vary Qmax around, that's roughly speaking, what that's telling you is that the model, including all these systematics, including the charge, the electromagnetic radius, and, you know, the electric and magnetic radius pieces, is just not a good fit to the data globally. If it were a good fit to the data globally, you should get consistent measurements from all subsets of the data.
Yeah. So what I mean, I think what I see here is that there's some sort of correlated systematic that depends on the Q squared that is not being taken into account, which would ideally tend to, you know, either raise the low Q squared data or lower.
Right. Well, I don't know what you mean to call it a correlated systematic. It's some physics, whether it's an offset or whatever, it's not being modeled.
Yeah, correct.
Right?
I think that's
what systematics are, roughly speaking.
But it's still systematics, right? It seems almost unavoidable. The conclusion is that there is something wrong with the QCD modeling of this. But none of the models that have been proposed so far are reasonable, except for the model where Kmax is one.
Right, which, again, should the Kmax equals to one model should fall into this larger class of models, right? And I think your ideal model would not depend on Kmax in the sense that adding larger Q squared data should not, you know.
Sure, of course. I think that's what the Phi is saying. But really, what we should take from this is that there is theory uncertainty, which is as large as, you know, going between 0.82 to 0.96.
Sure.
Wow, that's pretty depressing.
Well, I mean, we don't have, you know, in some sense, there's only an effective theory for, you know, proton interacting with photons. So.
No, this is depressing. This thing will never resolve this. Right? This will never resolve it. Honestly, it'll maybe resolve the new piece cutter.
And but yeah, so there you would have similar systematics, which, you know, I think a lot of these problems still exist in the new piece scattering scenario, and maybe even some new ones crop up. I haven't really thought about this deeply, but so, for example, a large log might be mitigated in the mu p scenario, right? Because then you'd be at mu and you'd be doing a lot better. But you know, a question of whether the existing TP models would do a good job, the other TP models would do a good job. That's all in question, I think, when it comes to mu p scattering. But I think that experiment's. Last I heard, or last year, it was in development. I can't remember when the turn on is. Maybe in a couple of years or so. I think there's a funding. There's still, the funding is not completely set yet. But.
Isn't that
supposed to
be devoted to
neon
physics?
PSI.
Yeah.
I think it's on the American side because they're American collaborators and they need to pitch it. Last I remembered.
To build observables, say, involving ratios of the muonic and electronic cross sections, in which some of these issues would just cancel out?
So, for the experimental ones, that I don't know. That would depend on how good the. That would depend on things that are outside sort of the theory control, like how good are the, spectrometers or whatever, their resolution. Because these are two different, at that point it would be two different experiments, right? So I think if you took out all the experimental uncertainties and then we're just looking at what was left, again, the large logs would be different in the muonic case, so those were not, so that's something you could maybe discriminate. One would have to be careful because the leptonic, is this true? No, that should be the same, sorry. One question would be, do the existing TP models use, are they good enough, are they good for the mu p scattering system as well as the EP scattering system? In, I'm trying to think if effective field theory, we have to say anything about it. I think you could probably take those into account, and then afterwards, yeah, I don't know. But that might be a good discriminant to consider. Thank you.